The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Mayor Mike Bloomberg. Remember to dial 311 for all New York City government services and information.
You're listening to 91.5 WNYE-FM and HD1 New York.
The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the views of NYC Media Group, its management, or any entity affiliated with either.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We have a lot of good quality information to share, and as we do 15 hours a week, it's always meant to empower us. Today, I'm going to talk about why we're so fat. Also, alien force, oceans, and skies, genetically engineered force altering the chemistry of the atmosphere and hydrosphere. This is about what we're doing to change bees and moss and butterflies and bats and plants. It's all happening due to genetic engineering. We'll deal with that. Also, tell Larry Summers, don't delay. Glad to see you go. But more importantly, I'm going to be asking a basic question to people in this audience. And I'm going to ask it early up front, and then later when I open my calls, I'd like you to call in and give your response to it, a question of the day. You've heard about the official poverty rate in the United States. Don't believe it. It's much worse than you think. I'll give you an exclusive look from David DeGraw, a scholar on this, who will tell us how many Americans are really poor and why those numbers are staggering, and why the government doesn't want you to know that. My guest in the second part of our program today will be James Howard Kunstler. He is a multi-award-winning author, and we're going to talk about something that is unique. You've heard Gerald Salante, you've heard others talk about Leopold, how they believe that we are going into a very dark period for most Americans and what it's likely to look like and how quickly it is going to be upon us. Well, today we're going to go one step further. How does James Howard Kunstler see the degradation of American society in relationship to peak oil, economic crisis, the degradation of intellectual integrity? In other words, what does he see happening in different areas of America? It'll be a very interesting conversation. So those are what we're up to, and let's get started. And again, we select the information to talk about on this program based upon what other people are not discussing that I believe is important. And I believe it's important to talk about how poor we really are and what we can do to turn it around and our health. For example, the United States per population is the fattest nation in the world. Now, the latest studies, and this was released just today, shows that, quote, chances are slim to none that the U.S. will meet its public health goal of sharply reducing the number of obese adults this year. That's according to CDC. Now, we have an awful lot of people today who are fat. Think back. Were you alive in the 1960s? Just think around. Look around in your mind at your classrooms and people on the street and in-laws you knew. How many were fat or obese? Well, the statistics were that it was relatively few Americans. We had somewhere around 10 to 13%. Then it escalated, and it went up from there. Today, just obese. I'm only talking about obese. That means first you're fat. You're overweight. Then you're fat. And then you're obese, then you're morbidly obese. So you really have to be fat to be obese. Today, it's 15%. So we went from 10 to 12% overweight to 15% obese. Well, put another way, that means people at risk of a heart attack, stroke, cancer, arthritis, and metabolic disorders and diabetes is now about 50 million. Now, that does not account for all the people who are simply overweight. That's another 100 million. So one half the entire American population are overweight. And what are we doing about it? Well, how about nothing? I read the International Journal of Obesity. I take a look at all the scientific literature, and I can see nothing that we're doing that's getting at the problem. And it's relatively simple. There's nothing complicated about it. Most of the food we're eating is not healthy. It's overly processed. It's denatured. It's empty calories. But it tastes good for most people. A whole generation was raised on thinking pizza was a good meal. It's got dairy and wheat. It's got dead meat that doesn't go bad, like pepperoni. And as a result, all of these are pro-inflammatory. And they're highly mucus-creating. And they are toxic on our intestines. And they're very difficult upon our livers. And they're high in sodium. All that means that from early on in life, we are eating towards disease, not towards wellness. And it's an exception when someone actually does something that's good for them, unless they come from background where the parents are insistent. If we had a national group of leaders, policymakers, and opinion leaders working together, where they were the reality show, they were what we saw every day. Could you imagine having a president and members of Congress that only ate healthy food, only drank healthy juices, exercised, de-stressed, detoxed, what that would mean? Could you imagine if all the celebrities were the same way? Well, overnight you would transform America's health, because we only follow the leaders, unless you're one of those unique independent thinkers, like a creative assertive or dynamic assertive. Otherwise, everyone else follows the group. So we're not doing that. So until we get really health-conscious leaders and health-conscious individuals, we're not going to have a healthy nation. It's just not going to happen. Probiotics. I believe we should be having them in our system at least 3 times a day. Here's the latest on probiotics. In this randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study of 272 individuals, they showed that the daily consumption of Lactobacillus and Parkasia and Lactobacillus plantarum, these are two different types of probiotics, was substantially beneficial in stopping the common cold. That's right. We're not talking about vitamin C now. We're talking about probiotics fighting the common cold. They had a 67% improvement in stopping the cold as compared to a placebo, and that was in the European Journal of Nutrition. I suggest anywhere from 10 to 20 billion positive bacteria per day. Remember, the common cold is a viral infection primarily caused by rhinovirus. It's the most common infection disease in humans and responsible for about 500 million illnesses in the United States every year. According to a study published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, the common cold and related disease cost us about $40 billion a year. Well, probiotics and prebiotics have been reported to potentially reduce the incidence of upper respiratory tract infections. Indeed, researchers in this study showed that you decrease upper respiratory tract infections. Why? Because you're helping strengthen the immune system. And when you strengthen the immune system, you're limiting rhinitis, sinusitis, and all these other itises. You're lessening them. Why? Because living microorganisms that are beneficial to the system confer health. That's why. So that's good news. Also, all around you are herbs and plants that heal. They'll heal wounds. They'll ease your colds and treat chronic conditions like allergies and heart disease. And we're just not paying enough attention to them, and we should. Most herbs used as medicine are gathered from natural environments, often growing right in front of us, and we just don't pay attention to it. Like purslane, very good. Even yarrow, Y-A-R-R-O-W, It's very important. It grows everywhere, and it's been cultivated as medicinal. Yet people don't know what it looks like, don't know what to use it for, and hence they just think it's a weed. Well, students in one study were asked, and this is in herbology, were asked to take a look to see what they could do with different herbs. And they found that they had all these herbs just in their immediate environment. It was kind of a fun little study just to say, look around you, what can you find? And they found dozens of different herbs growing in common areas, in people's backyards, under trees, in woods. So I believe that we should have a whole national program on getting people familiar with the healing herbs and plants that exist right with us, that we cohabitate with, so we can start to use them. Everything from hawthorn and scarlet gilia and Brown's peony and choke cherry, valerian, all of these, they're just all around us, and they can do everything from helping us with, like, feverfew for head problems. We just have to pay attention. You're going to eat that genetically engineered salmon? I hope not. But a group of wanted to identify salmon that was not genetically engineered, and the FDA said, no, you can't do that. So even though we have real no good long-term studies and none on human health showing what the genes in a salmon will do to the genes in a human, we're told you cannot identify one that is without it. That shows you the politics behind the FDA and its affiliation and control by the major multi-corporations. So now you want to buy salmon, you won't know whether it's genetically engineered or not. I'm Gary Nall. Now, before we go to our break, I want to share this little comment with you. It's from Mary Batari, and then there's a question that goes behind it. This is short, so I'll read it. It says, Larry Summers is confirming rumors that he plans on leaving his job as president's chief economic advisor at the end of the year. And while some may consider this a panicky attempt to hightail it out the door before he is blamed for significant Democratic losses this election cycle, I see it in a more positive light. On Wall Street, Summers will be greeted like a conquering hero. Never have so many financiers been made so rich because of the actions of one man. Plus, he can go back to that genius Wall Street salary when he worked for his former personaire hedge fund, D.E. Shaw. He worked one day a week and earned $5 million before being picked by Obama to lead the National Economic Council. That's a lot of money. Now, here's his resume. Summers has a long resume that makes him an ideal candidate for a job on Wall Street. For years, he promoted the concept of post-industrial age, where manufacturing is not important. Get rid of the manufacturing. Ship it off to India, China. No, we want, quote, this is from him, financial markets do not just oil the wheels of economic growth, they are the wheels, unquote. So he wanted all of our energy to be put into Wall Street. And between 1992 and 2001, he held various positions in the U.S. Treasury Department, including that of Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton from 1999-2001. Summers has described the 1990s as a time when important steps were taken to achieve, quote, deregulation in key sectors of the economy, such as financial services, to provide the right framework, quote, for a financial industry to thrive. Ah, here's what he did. He was the principal player in the elimination of the Glass-Steagall. Along with Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan, Summers brought about the elimination of the single key financial regulation, the Glass-Steagall Act. And Summers argued for elimination of the Glass-Steagall Act by saying, quote, it imposed archaic financial restrictions on our leadership of the world's financial markets would be enhanced, and consumers would see the benefits in the form of greater innovation and lower prices, that innovation led directly to the formation of too-big-to-fail firms that were allowed to gamble in the securities market like never before, And that's what caused the collapse of our global economy. He also didn't want anyone to touch derivatives. And remember, derivatives is where the money is made. Summers was particularly aggressive in his efforts to block regulations of derivatives and regulations that might have prevented the 2008 economic meltdown. And while he was at the Treasury Department, his enthusiasm for financial deregulation conflicted with the views of the woman I mentioned yesterday, Brooksley Bourne. She was chair of the Commodities Future Trading Commission, and Bourne had extensive experience working as a lawyer in the derivative area and was concerned about the lack of transparency in this multi-trillion-dollar financial market. And Summers collaborated with Alan Greenspan, Robert Rubin, and Arthur Levitt to block Bourne's efforts to regulate this market. According to New York Times reporter Timothy O'Brien, quote, they were all part of a very concerted effort to shut her up and shut her down. And they did, in fact, shut her up and shut her down. Robert Rubin is not a guy who likes confrontation. He's confrontation averse, but he understands that you need someone in there who can swing a heavy axe. And that person was Larry Summers. He was the enforcer, unquote. Then let's take a look at Enron. Remember Enron, the smartest guys in the room? When he was about to take office as Treasury Secretary, Summers received a congratulatory letter from Ken Lay, the president of Enron Corporation. The letter was addressed to, quote, Dear Larry. And in his response addressed to Ken, Summers promised, quote, I'll keep my eye on power deregulation and energy market infrastructure issues. In other words, I'm looking after you, Enron. During the California energy crisis in 2000, Summers rejected the idea that energy companies like Enron were manipulating the market and gouging consumers. Oh, Larry, but that's exactly what they did. He opposed Governor Gray Davis's plan for government intervention with price controls, claiming, quote, this is a classic supply and demand. The only way to fix this is ultimately to allow retail prices to go wherever they will go. Well, how about into the pockets of Ken Lay and all the best and brightest at Enron? And how about the destruction of the seventh largest Fortune 500 company in America? Yeah. And what about his role at Harvard? We hear he was the president of Harvard. Yeah, he was. Summers became president of Harvard University in 2001 and resigned in 2006, leaving behind a ticking time bomb of interest rate swaps that he'd helped negotiate in 2004. According to Bloomberg, quote, the swaps, which assumed that interest rates would rise, proved so toxic that the 373-year-old institution agreed to pay banks a total of $1 billion to terminate them. Boy, they levy at Harvard, don't they? You only cost them $1 billion. A billion. And then what about the role in the bailout and stimulus? You didn't hear about Summers in that, did you? No. Well, I'm going to tell you. Summers had a key role in determining the size of the federal bailout of the financial services industry. All government programs add up to $4.7 trillion. And of the economic stimulus package the Obama administration submitted to Congress, $787 billion, the stimulus package was much smaller than what was being recommended by many economists. As a result, the U.S. has been stuck at a near double-digit unemployment for almost 2 years. Last year, economist Paul Krugman warned that while cutting the size of the stimulus might get more Republican votes, it would fail to significantly reduce unemployment. Today, Wall Street is bouncing back with healthy profit margins and even healthier bonuses. Not Main Street. It's still in the Great Recession, and I believe going into a depression. Now, why do I tell you this? Because here's the issue. So let us get this in proper context. I believe that it would have been wise for the president to have brought in Howard Dean to be his chief of staff, not Ron Emanuel. He could have brought in Elizabeth Warren. He could have brought in Rubini to be his chief economic advisor, Joseph Stiglitz. These people, including the Nobel Prize winner, would have not allowed the type of bailouts nor the too big to fail. They would have allowed these major institutions to have gone into bankruptcy, restructured their debt, and emerged healthy, but without us bailing them out and without them exploiting it and getting the people who made the mistakes out of jobs. He did not do that. He took probably the most repugnant economist in American history, the man who is so anti average person, loathing Main Street, such an egotist, despising any kind of real reform, and he puts this man who had caused the destruction of the Glass-Steagall Act, had gotten the one woman in government out of office at the Commodities Future Training Bureau, and he saw that there was complete deregulation. He opened up all the bank doors and allowed the bankers to carry what they wanted out. That's who Barack Obama chose, along with all the other accomplices. So when people tell me that, oh, Barack Obama, you know, he's just, you know, he's give him a chance. He's had his chance. And now, who is he picking to replace Lawrence Summers? A man equally in contempt of reform and of the same mindset. And who's he going to replace with the... who's on his short list to replace Ron Emanuel and some of the other people? All corporatists. At no time has Barack Obama ever, not once, selected to run a major agency a reformist, a person of the people, and a person who has a reputation for standing up to corruption. Not once. So when you make that many mistakes, and now you're going to make the whole set of mistakes all over again, then it's not a mistake you're making. It's honoring the people who control the agenda. That's what it is. I'd like your thoughts. What can we learn from the people the president surrounds himself with, the president and how he makes these selections, then how not a single progressive, not a single reformer, not a single independent has been selected for a single government agency since he was taking an office. Your thoughts on that? I'd like to hear your input. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
My room every night, and just a sprinkle of stardust and a whisper, go to sleep. Everything is all right. I close my eyes, then I drift away into the magic night. I softly say a silent prayer, like then I fall asleep to dream my dreams of you. In dreams I walk with you. In dreams I talk to you.
I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you all with us today. We'll be going to our guest in about 15 minutes. He is James Howard Kunstler. We're going to talk about what he sees the coming near times next year, the year after. I'm just going to talk about the next 5 years in suburban, urban, and rural America. We'll talk with him shortly. Carrie Lee's joining us in studio in New York City. I'm out on the road, getting very close to having some major filming completed. And yesterday we posted the new original in-depth investigative reporting piece, Richard Gale and myself, on vaccine genocide. How the Gates Foundations, Bill Gates and Rockefeller Foundation, are trying to depopulate the world with vaccines and doing so stealthily. It's an important piece, and hopefully you will read it and pass it on. Passing it on is how we allow those of us who are independent-minded and are concerned about the plight and needs of the average person to know the truth. You will not see this truth ever in the mainstream media. They dare not touch these topics. They won't touch these at all. But we will. So keep sharing it. Pass it on. Now, real quick, before we go inside, this is our little short fundraising piece for the Progressive Radio Network. And keep in mind, no other program on the Progressive Radio Network ever has to raise money at all. You can't say that on NPR. You can't say that on Pacifica stations. You can say it here. And that's because I'm the only show that raises the money for the network. And all the money, 100%, goes to the network. Jessica Lee said, let's put together, and she does it upstairs, and she said, two items and make it a special and give it to them at half price. And I said, fine. One is Mellow Fellow. Now, I formulated that for people who live stressful lifestyles. And Mellow Fellow has the nutrients that I believe can make an enormous difference. I put in there St. John's Wort, 300 milligrams. That's the dosage I recommend. Chamomile, 10 milligrams. Catnip, 10 milligrams. Lemon leaf balm, 10 milligrams. Lavender flower, 15 milligrams. Rosemary, oat straw, logan fruit, hops, skullcap, theanine, GABA, valerian, magnesium, and calcium. All together in the potencies I believe can provide the best benefit to the consumer. It's called Mellow Fellow. For anyone who's a little stressed, anyone suffering from a little anxiety, anyone who needs just to take the edge off, Mellow Fellow. That's one of the items. The second is our outstanding Advanced Supremacy, the buffered vitamin C with bioflavonoids for enhanced utilization. The major antioxidant vitamin, and there you're getting 2,200 milligrams of vitamin C plus in a single serving, plus potassium and cranberry, blueberry, and bioflavonoids, acerola, and amia fruit extract. And so that those two together represent our special today. So if you'd like this great special, the Advanced Supremacy, and which I take every day, plus the Mellow Fellow. And by the way, if you're not stressed at all, you have no problem, then give it to someone you know who is stressed. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065 for a 50% off Mellow Fellow and Advanced Supremacy. Now into our studio in New York City, and we have Carol Lee. But Carol Lee, I did ask people to call in, and I have Bill from Queens on, and let's see what Bill has to say on this. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you, Gary?
Good.
Good to talk to you. I don't know, I have a couple issues that I'd like to ask you. I mean, you know, we've been in international bankruptcy since the inception of our country. I think the first one started in 1789 when the King of England bought our debt. You know, Continental Congress had a $13 million debt, and we owed money at that point. And then 1859, you know, 7 years international bankruptcy from what I've been studying. And then we had the Civil War. And then 1929, we had the stock market crash, and they took away our gold and took away our ability to own property. And, you know, I don't understand, like, what's the alternative? I mean, here we have the Federal Reserve, who controls our country, essentially. And I know they're, you know, quasi-government, yada, yada, yada. But what's going to happen? I mean, Saddam Hussein in 1990 told the international bankers, hey, go scratch, I'm not paying you more money. And we came and destroyed his country. I mean, what happens when America says, hey, you know, we want the Federal Reserve, and we're not paying our debt off to the international bankers or paying off our debt to whoever, and they come in and collect their funds? I mean,
well,
you know,
they can't do that. There is no power that will have that temerity to do that. What people can do around the world, they can decide if they do at some point that they no longer want to fund our debt. in which case then we have to monetize the debt, and that is the purpose of the Federal Reserve. It can simply print money out of thin air with nothing to back it up, because you either have people at the local level buy bonds and then have a certain interest rate, 3%, 5% of maturity on the bonds, so you can build things or have things that help the common good. Or you raise taxes and spend it through your treasury. Or you go out to India, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the United Emirates, and China, and you say, look, we need about $12 billion a week minimum. That's minimum. And they say, okay, what do we get in return? You're not giving us any interest rate that makes a difference. But they give us their open, we lower our markets, and so now our Kmarts and Walmarts are carrying their cheap goods, which allows their countries to have 8, 10, 12% economic growth per year.
But then we lose our manufacturing base. At the end of the tunnel, what happens if it's the light at the end of the tunnel?
There's a time to where you have to get out of the tunnel. Our problem is both the Democrats and Republicans, who have been in office for over 35 to 40 years, both of them are supporting the corporatist, multinational, globalist agenda. We have to get populist people in positions of power, not those who are right-wing. We need a combination, and it does not exist now, but it will. It will. There's good news here. We need a combination of a progressive libertarian. That's what we need, a progressive libertarian, someone who is not the full functional libertarian, someone who still realizes we do need...
It's a wonderful thought, but I think that you said it very succinctly a couple of weeks back. You said, you know, there's 536 people that control 300 million. I think that the people that are in charge... You know, like the Senator Wellstone from Minnesota, whatever where his plane miraculously, you know, had an accident right before he was going to do a major vote on the Gulf War. I mean, I don't know. I mean, what is it going to take for people to wake up? You think that's actually that?
Do you remember what I said the other day? It will take an entire election cycle. It will take us for Hillary Clinton, who will be the next president, mark my words on that, and she'll be running against Mitt Romney and or Sarah Palin. It will take one whole election cycle before we finally realize that both the Democrats and Republicans have betrayed the average American. There is nothing helping us out. And that's when, like France and Ireland and other countries, you start to see people without the historical and traditional leadership of the Democratic or Republican sides going to the streets. There'll be tax protests. There'll be protests of every type. People begin to boycott home medias. They'll begin to boycott stores. You'll have average people boycotting Walmart. Right now, the stupidity is that someone who lost their job, who had a gainful employed job for decades, is now going to Walmart to buy the products they used to manufacture without seeing the irony in that. And
I have a friend of mine that worked for IBM for 15 years. He's a head engineer. And his whole division just got let go. And, you know, it's like... He's one of 300 or 400 guys that got put out.
But understand why he lost his job. He didn't lose his job because he was doing a bad job, and he didn't lose his job because he made wrong decisions. He lost his job for one reason only. Because Wall Street controls the stock values, and the stock values are controlled by how much can they show their profitability is, and are they meeting their profit expectations. If they are, then they're recommended buy. If not, then they're not. So the people who run these corporations realize that their reloaded stock options and their bonuses are based upon if they meet certain goals. That means if they have to cut off a lot of the employees, if they have to reduce the hours, if they have to sell off units, they will do all that as long as they don't jeopardize their own ruling position and the benefits of that corporate elite mindset. That's what you have happening. It's not about running a good company, which IBM always has been, and having good relationship with your employees. For decades, it was considered the best model of any corporation in the United States, better than U.S. Steel, better than General Motors, better than General Electric. It was IBM. All that changed when the profits became more important than people, their security, or the quality of that work environment. And now you can take those same components made by IBM around the United States, and you can make them in China and bring them back here. In fact, the largest amount of pirated IBM software in the world is made in China, fully with the complete knowledge of the Chinese government officials. And so we still have a group of people in power who are allowing outsourcing. When you have people say outsourcing is against the law, you cannot do it. That hasn't happened and won't happen. You have to have another cycle. Remember, this...
I think you're too much of an optimist.
Look, I am an optimist because I've seen too many people walk out of my office and a year later they're alive where they should have been dead. If you sat in my shoes and you saw how many times people said something couldn't be done, and we found that it could be done. It's like this. Let's say that you were the cynic and you said, well, you've shown me 25,000 cases of UFOs and they're all something else. And I said, fine. And then I show you one that you can't dismiss. We have to rely upon a new form of media. Why do you think I put so much time, energy, and effort and resources into Progressive Radio Network?
Gary, you're a blessing.
Okay, because the progressives like Danny Schachter, Michio Kaku, and all the others, they're here. It's a small home, but guess who's the fastest growing internet radio station in the world? Progressive Radio Network. Guess who's got the number one radio show in the world listened to progressive and open-minded people? Right now you're listening to it. So look for the positive. Look for what we are doing. You don't see the 20,000 emails I get and messages and every week of people who are seeking change, made change, and passing on change. We just had an article that I was just told hit 5,000 of the biggest websites in the world and the progressive websites, which means about conservatively 10 to 15 million people read it yesterday. It's number two on Google under the Gates Foundation. Number two. All right? So look at what we're doing that is good. Stop focusing upon nihilistic, apocalyptic, negative. Be positive. Think positive. Think out of the box. I understand your frustration. I really do. And I'm glad that you called in. But we're not done yet. We're just beginning. And I'm very optimistic about what those who no longer choose to be in that down, depressing, dark place of Pacifica, or that fairyland of opulence and jubilant thinking of what they can do when they can control the world, the Republicans. And those are all illusions, and none of them have answers, and none of them care about the average people. So don't try to compete with them. We shouldn't be competing. And in time, we will establish through the thousands upon tens of thousands of conscientious, progressive-minded people, we will have answers they don't have. Okay? Thanks a lot for your call. I don't want to keep my guest on hold. We're going to get my guest up now and go over and say hello to him. He is James, and I'll come back. We'll talk whatever Kara had. We'll do that tomorrow. By the way, a two-hour special tomorrow on vaccines. 2 hours. And I just finished filming this week two Harvard MDs on vaccines. One's a professor and an MD and board certified. The other is an MD board certified, not a professor. They had some really strong thoughts on this topic. And I will put that up there next week. Now let's go over and say hello to James Howard Kunstler. As I mentioned earlier in the introduction, he's an award-winning author, both fiction and nonfiction books. And we're here to talk about taking a look at America over the next 1 to 5 years through his eyes and see what he sees and what he believes are going to be the outcome. He did a follow-up of his earlier books, The Witch of Hebron, and we're here to talk about the future. Nice to have you with us today, Howard. James?
Nice to be here.
I'm going to give you just an overview and then ask you to take it wherever you choose, all right?
Sure.
With the idea of looking at the future. 1989, I was looking for property where I could create a homestead. And I found one down in a little tiny town in Texas called Tioga, north of Denton, north of Dallas. But the day that I was going in to sign the contract, I'm walking around the streets of Sherman, Texas, and every other store was closed. And the ones that were open had old stuff that looked like from the 1950s. Kind of reminded me of that movie, The Last Picture Show, with Sybil Shepherd and Jeff Bridges. It was really an old feel to it. And I asked someone in a local diner, I said, "What's going on here?" He says, "Oh," he said, "you know, we've been left behind. That's what's going on here." And he said, "All the young people are gone." He said, "Just the old time people are sticking around." He said, "This is kind of a place that the final curtain's going down on." Now, 10 years before that, in 1979, I was in Denver, and I was driving out to Boulder, and it was a beautiful. You ever been to Boulder?
Of course.
Okay, a beautiful drive out, and you had those big meadows, and then there was one street that didn't have traffic on it, and they had all these wonderful shops and stores, and I think it was called the Sunflower Restaurant. And anyhow, I looked at this bulletin board, and what surprised me about this bulletin board, there were more notices for lectures and workshops on things that interested me in health than I'd ever seen in New York or Los Angeles. And there was just this kind of exuberance, this optimism. Things were brightened up, and I took a walk from that street up to the Grand Canyon, and you could actually walk. It was about a 20-minute walk, and you could see the Grand Canyon. I just returned to both places. Boulder is so congested that there's a massive traffic line getting in and out. The city has lost its exuberance. It's overbuilt. There's desperation. Houses values are falling. Aside from the fires that just knocked out about 160 of their homes last week, and the same in Texas. Now I look at the future, and I just came back 2 weeks ago from Sedona. Same thing there. Every sixth store is out of business. The people there are desperate. Their idealism that they held for decades is now waning. Now I'm saying, okay, through your eyes, James, show us what it's going to be like in suburban America, which is directly codependent upon urban America, for its future, especially with the increasing rates of crime and people being hungry, and over 53 million Americans now being on some form of assistance for food stamps or under the poverty level, and another 100 million Americans struggling who are the working middle class, and another 70 million who are struggling. What's the future going to be for these people who don't live in the gated communities and don't live in nice high rises and safe environments when it comes to food and water and fuel, especially in post-peak oil America? And I don't believe that we have had any concept or any conscious awareness of what's about to hit us. And I'm feeling, and I hope I'm wrong, that we are like the people who see the wave going out before the tsunami comes out and say, "That's interesting. Where's all the water going?" And I'm saying, why don't we pay attention to what the likely outcome of our current activities are going to create for us? The forum is yours.
Well, we're not paying attention, and we're not paying attention because we have a kind of comprehensive failure of leadership, and it's not just political leadership. It's a failure of leadership in business and in the media and in the colleges and classrooms. And there's so much noise in the system now, and we're doing such a poor job of constructing a coherent consensus about what is happening to us and what we're going to do about it. And part of the reason for this is that the trends are probably simply too painful. Certainly they're too painful for our political leaders. And the trends are basically as follows. We're in kind of a horse race right now between two forces that are both capable of putting us out of business as an advanced technological industrial civilization. And they're both going pretty strong. And one force is the fiasco in banking and the troubles we're having with capital and money and currencies and all things related to how we value things and how we create markers of value for what we produce in our civilization. So the money system is in terrible trouble, and the trouble is accelerating. That's one of the forces. The other force is the global resource problem, and the main part of that is the global energy resource problem, namely oil. And our oil situation in the United States is much more desperate than the public realizes. You know, many people, the delusional thinking out there is very strong, and it is rising in direct proportion to the economic distress that is being felt. And you can state categorically that it's going to get worse as more distress occurs. But the U.S. public has no idea how fragile our oil delivery system is. Unfortunately, many Americans think that the earth has a creamy nougat center, like a bonbon, a creamy nougat center of oil that will run forever. And it's just not true. We import more than two-thirds of our oil, increasingly from places that themselves are entering depletion, which are using more of their own oil and have less to export. And, you know, we're quite at the mercy of other nations who are not really that friendly to us, who don't really want us necessarily to succeed or to thrive or be happy. They're, you know, in many cases, they're our adversaries. But I think for the moment, to cut to the chase, the problems in capital and finance and banking are outrunning even our energy resource problems to put us out of business. And what this means in a nutshell is there simply will be no money. You know, everybody will be broke. We are now increasingly bankrupt at all levels of American life, including our households, our enterprise levels, and all levels of government. So that's the current situation. It's too painful. Our leaders are hoping that some miracle will kind of pull us through and that we'll resume something like the cheap oil fiesta that we experienced at the end of the 20th century and beginning of this one. And, you know, they're just sort of sitting there with their fingers crossed, and we're not doing really anything about it.
I appreciate that insight. Now give us a little different perspective, if you would, please. We must prepare for some massive electrical output collapses. We must prepare for when we can't afford gasoline or gasoline is in diminished supply. We also have to look at what's going to happen to our manufacturing segments, Walmarts and Home Depots, when they don't have all the products to put in their stores, and even the pharmaceutical industry. I don't see any specific industry, including food, that is not adversely affected as we run out of money to pay for things and as these energy and financial intense industries begin to have to reconfigure themselves. How do you see it?
Well, we're in for a major reset. Among the delusions out there right now and the magical thinking and the wishful thinking is the idea that some combination of alternative energy schemes is going to allow us to run Walmart and the interstate highway system and suburbia and the U.S. military and Walt Disney World. And the truth is that no combination of alternative energy will allow us to run that stuff or even a substantial fraction of it. I want to be very clear, though, because I'm not inveighing against alternative energy, but I would warn America that we are going to be disappointed by what these things can do for us. I think we're going to do everything we can, and we're going to try everything we can, but we're not going to run our stuff the way we've been running it on these things, and we really have to behave differently. We have to live differently, and we have to make other arrangements for daily life.
How do you
and we're not thinking
we
about that at all.
James, how do you suggest we do that? Give us your ideas.
There are two things that really you can state categorically that we have to do immediately. One is that we have to start directing our dwindling resources of both capital and real commodity resources, including oil and ores and even the rare earths that are necessary to build electronic equipment and batteries. We have to direct our dwindling resources to the very serious task of downscaling and relocalizing the major activities of U.S. life. And these include, you know, you can state these with precision. They're not abstract. They include the way we do agriculture, that is, the way we produce our food, the way we do commerce. Walmart is going, and everything like it, is going to go out of business. And we're going to have to reconstruct our local networks of economic interdependency, otherwise known as Main Street or the business district in your town. We're going to have to inhabit the landscape differently because suburbia is going to fail. And by the way, our enormous, gigantic metroplex cities are going to fail too, but in a different way.
Which ones?
Pardon?
Which of these cities?
They're all going to fail to some degree, but of course, the large Sun Belt cities that are composed primarily of suburban sprawl are going to be in the most trouble, and the cities that are overburdened with skyscrapers are also going to be in trouble. We're going to discover that the skyscraper is not an asset. It's a liability. We're going to have a lot of trouble with them in the future. And the places that will be successful will be the smaller cities and smaller towns, which by and large are lying out there deactivated and depopulated right now. And the places that are have a meaningful relationship with nearby agricultural land, the places that will obviously not be successful will be places like Phoenix, Tucson, you know, Las Vegas. These places are toast. There are going to be a lot of demographic shifts going on, but it's not going to work out the way a lot of people fantasize. You know, when the suburbs get into a real state of failure, everybody's not going to rush to the city. It's going to be a much messier process.
Please hold your thoughts, James Howard Kunstler. We're going to say goodbye to our WMYE audience, and you can continue listening by going to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or GaryNall.com. We have still some more to look at here of what's going to be happening. Now, let's continue to pick up on that. So right now, you're saying cities like Los Angeles, Tampa, Orlando.
Atlanta, Dallas, Houston, et cetera. But also Philadelphia, you know, New York City is going to get into trouble. They'll all get into trouble.
How do you see the trouble manifesting in New York City?
Well, these places are not scaled to the energy realities of the future. That's one thing. You know, another thing is, and that's a pretty broad-based statement. You know, what it basically means is we're simply not going to have the energy inputs to run them. But we're also not going to have the capital to keep them repaired and to maintain them. And we're also not going to have the capital to have a dynamic enough economy to employ all the people in them, and they're going to get increasingly restless and ticked off.
Well, we cannot leave out of this equation some reality checks as far as as crime, banditry, religious cults, a whole lot's going to start happening where people pull together by what they consider their need for survival. And the poorest are going to have a greater need for survival, because if we're making cuts now, imagine how radical our cuts will be when we don't have a population base paying the taxes to support the basic infrastructures of local, state, and federal governments. And what will that mean? Could you give us what that will look like?
Well, I actually wrote a couple of novels about this, and many people perhaps know my 2005 book, The Long Emergency, which was about this combination of forces that are going to get us into trouble. Excuse me. But after that, I wrote two novels as an attempt to imagine what life would be like in the post-oil American future. And the first one was called World Made by Hand, and it was published in 2008 by the Atlantic Monthly Press. And the sequel to it just came out this month. It's called The Witch of Hebron, and it's a continuation of the story with the same characters. The story set in a small town in upstate New York after really a kind of an economic collapse has occurred. And it's a very austere new American world without anything like the comforts and conveniences that we have, that we're used to. But it is not in a state of anarchy or barbarism. I just suggest that readers or listeners may be interested to check them out.
So final thoughts.
Final thoughts.
Where do you see when do you see this happening, and where do you see people should be paying attention to making changes in their life?
We are in the zone of what I've called the long emergency for a while. We've been in it for a while. Really, I think you could say maybe the official start of it was the 2008 Wall Street crash. There are so many things we have to do. As a kind of national community, I've been suggesting for a while that we really have to pull together and do a project that will help us build our confidence for the future. And that one project that I suggest is rebuilding the conventional railroad system. We're too broke to build high-speed rail. It just isn't going to happen. It's one of those fantasies. But we're going to desperately need a real conventional railroad system to get around this large nation with, if we're going to hang together. And that's a project that we can do, and we still have the resources to do it, and I hope Americans will turn that into a political issue.
That's a good idea. Hadn't thought about that. That's a very good idea. Well, I thank you very much for your insights. I appreciate them, and hopefully people will take the time to read these projects of yours. And give us your website, please.
It's www.kunstler.com.
Thank you very much, James Howard Kunstler, for being on.
A pleasure to be in a very thoughtful show.
Thank you. I'm Gary Knoll. That's it for today. Stay tuned in just a few moments. Mike Fader and The Turning Point. I'll be back tomorrow with a two-hour special you won't want to miss, exploring the safety and efficacy of vaccines, and we will show you what the CDC, the FDA, the U.S. Public Health Service have refused to show you. There is a connection between vaccines and autism.
Produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.
Yep. testing 1, 2, more, higher, 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 testing more, more, right there is, hold on, let's see. Testing 1, 2, right, hold on a second. Testing 1, 2, 1, 2, that's a little higher, right there is good.
Join us as we connect people, ideas, important.